Morning. This morning I'm going to talk about Bendawa, which means the wholehearted way, the practice of the wholehearted way, which is a text by Dogen. It's the first one he wrote, maybe not the first one, but very close to the first one he wrote after he came back from China, where he had a deep awakening about the nature of reality. So when he came back from China, he felt like he knew enough to teach. He felt like he was going to, at that point, seriously start teaching the Dharma. So, usually these are called fascicles or the chapters of the Shobo. This is in the Shobo Genzo, which means true Dharma eye. Usually at the very beginning of one of Dogen's fascicles, the first couple of paragraphs are a summation of the meaning of the whole fascicle. I'm not going to talk about this all of this first part, but he says, all Buddha Tathagatas together have been simply transmitting the wondrous Dharma and actualizing Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, for which there is an unsurpassable, unfabricated, wondrous method. This wondrous Dharma, which has been transmitted only from Buddha to Buddha without deviation, has as its criterion Jijuyu Zanmai, which means self-fulfilling samadhi. For disporting oneself freely in this samadhi, practicing Zazen in an upright posture is the true gate. Although this Dharma is abundantly inherent in each person, it is not manifest without practice. It is not attained without realization. When you let go, the Dharma fills your hands. It is not within the boundary of one or many. When you try to speak, it fills your mouth. It is not limited to vertical or horizontal. Buddhas continuously dwell in and maintain this Dharma, yet no trace of conceptualization remains. Living beings constantly function in and use this Dharma, yet it does not appear in their perception. So those are the first, that's the first two paragraphs of Bendawa. So I'm looking at a book called The Wholehearted Way, which is a translation of a commentary by Kosho Uchiyama Roshi, who is Shohaku Okumura's teacher. It's a really wonderful book, so I recommend this. Okay, all Buddha Tathagatas together have been simply transmitting wondrous Dharma and actualizing Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, for which there is an unsurpassable, unfabricated, wondrous method. So what I want to do is break down this sentence and talk about the various parts of it. So all Buddha Tathagatas is how it starts out. So a Tathagata is a title for the Buddha, for a Buddha. It means, Tathagata means in Sanskrit, one who thus comes or one who has thus gone. Okay, one who thus comes, one who comes in suchness, one who goes beyond. So this way in which to come in suchness, to enact, to enact the understanding, non-conceptual understanding of the interconnectedness of all being. This non-conceptual understanding of what it means to say no inherently existent being, which includes understanding the continuous practice of all beings, which is understanding our place within this mandala of reality, the place of all beings within the mandala of reality, and how that is enacted. So to say one who thus comes is talking about a being, a person who embodies this deep understanding. To go, one who is thus gone, is to go beyond. In the heart sutra we say, gate, gate, paragate, parasangate, bodhisattva. To go beyond. So this is going beyond delusion, going beyond this or that, going beyond being completely presencing oneself. So this is this coming and going of reality itself, the coming, the going of the Tathagata, this realization of suchness and emptiness. So often we talk about, in Dogen talks about this a lot, he talks about coming and going, the phrase coming and going. So coming and going can be the coming and going of our everyday life, and we can talk about that. Often it's used in a way where we're talking about delusion. We're talking about a way in which our coming and going were caught in a kind of unhealthy desire. We're caught in a sequential understanding of the nature of our experience that gets in the way of actually being in the present moment. So that's a kind of coming and going that's a problem. And then there's coming and going that's a coming and going of just completely presencing yourself in this moment. Dogen says, it's a Chinese expression. Let's see if I can get this right. Before the horse business is done, the donkey business comes. So even though we may have ideas about horses and donkeys, it's this way of before this is done, the next thing is here. It's like it follows, it comes, it follows upon itself. So if we just presence ourselves in this moment, what is necessary will become apparent. We don't have to spend so much time about thinking, trying to figure out what the next thing is. That if we're actually presencing ourselves, it will come forward and reveal itself. So this coming and going that's an expression of our Buddha nature would include things like generosity, wisdom, appreciation, skillful action, right speech. So these are the activities of a Buddha. And then there's the word Buddha, so all Buddha Tathagatas. Buddha is having realized, having actualized understanding. Awake, the awakened one. One who knows, who's acting with this knowledge of the true nature of all of reality. So Buddha Tathagata, in some ways, is the same thing. They're emphasizing each other. So we understand that this Buddha, we say Buddha Tathagata, we also understand in Soto Zen that we're talking about Buddha nature. And again, Buddha nature is all of reality arising simultaneously. So in Dogen and Busho says, we do not have Buddha nature, because in some traditions the idea is that you practice lifetime after lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, and you sort of gradually acquire this thing called Buddha nature, and that enables you to attain the state of realization. So it means that it's a gradual thing. You have to do lifetime after lifetime after lifetime of practice. Dogen says you do not have Buddha nature. We are Buddha nature. All being is Buddha nature. So that means that this essential nature, this Tathagata, this Buddha nature is already inherently the nature of who we are. It is also inherently the nature of the table. So this is all of reality arising simultaneously. But, of course, the question is, so that's the non-dual understanding of it. Then the question is, in the relative, we mess up. We make mistakes. We are in delusion. We get caught. We're clinging. We get angry. We want things. Gets in the way. We get in fights with people. We get in fights with ourselves. So this way that we are Buddha nature, and yet Buddhahood is necessary. Realization is necessary for actualization of Buddha nature. Buddha nature is not potential. Buddha nature is reality itself, yet simultaneously it has to be expressed. And that expression is Buddhahood. That expression is Buddha Tathagata. Now, I've said this before, we often, without even thinking about it, express that nature. We express Buddha nature. I would say that in the sutras, traditionally, Buddha Tathagatas are pretty exalted beings because they don't ever get caught in delusion. So they're always expressing this. These kind of exalted Buddha images for us. These are the Buddhas who have long tongues, and their tongues roll out, a mile long maybe. They just roll out into the cosmos, and that represents that they are going to be able to say something that absolutely everybody understands in any language. So they're talking to an assembly of millions of beings, lay people, monks and nuns, Garudas, all these mythical beings. Their tongue rolls out. They have a tuft of hair between their forehead, and it shoots out a light, a golden light. in the Sambhogakaya realm, the enjoyment body of the Buddha shoots out this brilliant light, and suddenly everyone gets it, right? I wish I could do that for you today, but I cannot. So we'll just have to struggle along in our little realm here and do the best that we can. So there's that quality in the Buddha Tathagata, that quality of being able to do that. So all Buddha Tathagatas together, this is a really important word, all Buddha Tathagatas together. This all Buddhas together with Buddhas, Dogen talks about in a fascicle called A Buddha and a Buddha. He said, Buddhas alone together with Buddhas are directly able perfectly to realize the Buddha Dharma. Buddhas alone together with Buddhas are able to directly, to perfectly realize Buddha nature, to realize Buddha Dharma. This comes from the Lotus Sutra, which is a very famous sutra in our tradition. And the quote in the Lotus Sutra is, in the chapter, which is called Skillful Means, right? Upaya, this chapter, which is about skillful means. The Lotus Sutra says, the Dharma which the Buddhas have attained is foremost unique and difficult to understand. We'd all agree with that, right? Difficult to understand. No one but the Buddhas can completely know the real aspects of all phenomena. That is to say, their character, nature, substance, potentiality, function, cause, condition, result, effect, and essential unity. So that's talking about the qualities of phenomena. So this Buddhas together with Buddhas are able to understand something that's very difficult to understand. I would suggest to you that we are also Buddhas together with Buddhas, right? We are Buddhas together with Buddhas. And we don't, sometimes, you know, I think we inherently in our body understand something. So that's what we're trying to get close to, trying to understand what's already present. We're trying to understand this true nature that is who we are, essentially. So we are Buddhas alone. So there's this quality of a Buddha together with other Buddhas, able to perfectly realize it. So it is, we have that ability to perfectly realize the Dharma. We're not waiting for something to happen. In this very moment, right now, it's like, it's not here. It's here. It's there. So in this very moment, we are Buddhas together with Buddhas, and we're Buddhas in delusion, too. Sometimes perfectly realized Buddhas, don't even think about it, bang, it happens. Sometimes not so perfectly realized Buddhas who have to think about it, and then they get close to the truth. And then sometimes it's like, you know, big crash. So all Buddha Tathagatas together are simply transmitting. So here we have simply transmitting. The word simply transmitting in Japanese is tanden. So according to Shohaku Okamura in this book, The Wholehearted Way, this is a really key concept in practice. So tanden. Tan in Japanese means one. So what is being transmitted is one thing. We are learning one thing. We break it down to a lot of other things. We say right speech, we talk about right action, right livelihood. So we talk about the specifics of our lives, understanding the specifics of what's working and what's not working. But what we're understanding is this one thing. We're understanding about the nature of reality, this one thing that is reality itself. So that's what we're getting is the Buddha Dharma. That's what we're trying to understand. In the robe chant, we say in the morning, great robe of liberation, field, far beyond form and emptiness, wearing the Tathagata's teaching, benefiting all beings. We're not wearing the Tathagata's teachings, we're wearing the Tathagata's teaching. So there is one teaching that's being expressed. So that's one way to understand the word tan, the second way to understand it is to mean this one thing is transmitted from one person to another person. One person to another person. We say warm hand to warm hand. That's interesting to me because I think as human beings, we have to talk about this transmission from person to person. So I will talk about an electro, say, well, the trees speak the Dharma, right? The Zathu speak the Dharma. The sky speaks the Dharma. The stars speak the Dharma. Everything that you can name that we perceive as outside of ourselves and even ourselves, we speak the Dharma. We're preaching, constantly preaching the Dharma. And yet really, as human beings, we transmit the Dharma to each other. Because I think as human beings, we receive the Dharma constantly. We are bombarded kind of like, ultraviolet rays from the universe, you know, coming down invisibly, bombarding us. We're constantly being bombarded and preached to by the whole universe. And yet, our verification must come from a teacher. Our verification must come from this warm hand to warm hand. So we say, Dogen says very explicitly in his teachings that this is our understanding. And in Zen, we are very much interested in lineage, right? The lineage of the teaching. So the lineage starts with the seven Buddhas before Buddha and then hits Shakyamuni Buddha and then goes down person to person to person to person to person. Write down, I have a lineage document, write down to my teacher and then me when I receive Dharma transmission. And when you receive a rakusu, you get lineage paper with it. You know, your name is at the bottom. So this way that we're very much interested in warm hand to warm hand, because that's where we get the feedback. That's where it comes back to us, where we get the information, is this verification. Maybe flowers verify flowers. Stars verify stars. Worms verify worms. People verify people. So this warm hand to warm hand. So this is really, really, really important in our school. So he says that this teaching can only be transmitted from one person to another. And this transmission, we say, is a transmissionless transmission because it is this one thing that's being transmitted. So what I understand and what you understand in this way is the same thing. And at that point, we become one. And yet, simultaneously, we're still two different people, right? So we have to hold that simultaneously. This particularity, this universality arising simultaneously. Kategori Roshi would say super speed. Like that. What is it? What color is that? You know, what is it? What is it? What is it? This, that, this, that, this, that. Me, you, me, you, me, you. And then we become this thing, right? Oscillating back and forth. Which is it? Which is it? Well, it's not this or that. It's like something else that's happening in this moment. So he says, one. One. This simply transmitting. We talked about the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. You know, Sangha is important because this Sangha as one, if we talk about Sangha as one, we are Sangha. So we work out with each other. This is what our practice is. We are Buddhists together with Buddhists, working out what it is to be together with each other. Sometimes we make mistakes. Sometimes we're great with each other. I come down the hallway, I hear you guys talking. It makes me very happy. You know, everybody seems like, this morning when I came down the hall, people, like, you all seem excited. Like, you're happy to see each other. You know, and I hear that sound, and it makes me very happy to hear that Sangha sound, to hear that sound that you are making together. You're preaching this happy Dharma together. You know, that sound. It's not conceptual. I suppose I could listen very, very carefully. I could hear each thing that you're saying, but I like the other sound, right? I like the other sound that is also listening very carefully, but it's a different kind of listening. So this way in which the Sangha is so important, that this way that we explore the Dharma together. We say, what is this one thing? You know, how is it that I can engage my life with these people here in this moment, good and bad? It's almost like, I feel like I'm giving, like, you know, the beginning of a marriage ceremony here, you know. Everybody says, yes, I do, you know. You don't know at first that's what you signed up for, right? You don't know that's what it is. And then 10 years in, you're going, oh. So this Sangha, and we talk about Dharma. Dharma, this is this one thing. And this teacher-student relationship, right? This becoming one with teacher-student relationship. So these three things, we say the three treasures, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, right? Den means transmission. So we're having Tan Den, simply transmitting. So this transmission, this shared understanding, this transmission that we are all engaged in with each other, with reality, with life itself, this transmission. And also we talk about, in Zen, we talk a lot about student-teacher transmission. So we say, Jocko and I have Dharma transmission. So our teacher has said, I transmit to you my Dharma. And yet we say transmissionless transmission, because by the time Mel transmits his Dharma to us, there's this kind of oneness between us. So there's not really a transmission, yet there has to be this acknowledgement. There has to be this place where we say, yes, yes. So how does that happen? You know, how do we do this together with each other? Okay, so we've got, I think, all Buddhas together simply transmitting wondrous Dharma and actualizing Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. Wondrous Dharma in Japanese is myoho, myoho. Myo means something that we can't grasp with our intellect. It's very mysterious. Now, I would say, because I'm kind of a heady person, that there is this way in which sometimes we do have to understand intellectually what it is, where it is we're kind of going. You know, it's kind of like getting at your Garmin or something, or going on Google and say, I want to go somewhere. How do I get over 17? But the going over 17 is not intellectual, right? You get on the freeway, all these things are happening. You have a map that says, you know, you get off of that exit on Highway 1 and you pop out over here on the other side. But there's a lot going on that road that's not about intellect at all. And yet, it helps to have a road map. It helps to say, get off on this exit. Go this route. So we have the teachings. We teach each other. I teach, Jocko teaches, teachers teach. All the things that we read, all the experiences we have, we look at that and we say, oh, that's the roadmap. But that actual traveling the map is a mysterious event. That actual being together, Buddhas with Buddhas, is a very mysterious event. So it's beyond our intellect. Shohaku said, we cannot create it. Right? We cannot create this. So we can't make this up in our heads. We can't make it be a certain way. We have to put ourselves there and see what happens. That's Zazen, right? Zazen, we say, I'm going to come in here and I'm going to sit Zazen, or wherever it is I'm going to sit Zazen, and I'm going to stay put for however long that period of Zazen lasts. Teachers like to do things like leave and come back in an hour later. Like, you think the period of Zazen is going to be 40 minutes, so you're going, oh, what's going on here? What's going on here? This doesn't, you don't have a, you know, I'm not going to look at my watch. No, I'm not going to look at my watch. No, I'm not supposed to have my watch on anyway. So, you know, but it seems like the longest period of Zazen. They must have left the room. And then you find out, no, nobody went anywhere. It was only 40 minutes, but it seemed like eternity. And then sometimes it goes by just like that, right? Sometimes you're like, whoa, that's amazing. But whether it goes by like that or seems to last an eternity, our willingness to put ourselves there, the mystery of plopping ourselves down and saying, I'm just going to stay here. That's a mystery. We don't know what's going to happen that day. We don't know what it's going to be like. We go into the rest of our lives thinking, I know what's going to happen today. I know what it's going to be like when I get up this morning. I know what I want my coworkers to do. I know who I want this person to be. I know who I want to be. But there's that, and we often go to Zazen with the same idea, right? I want it to be a certain way. I want it to be this. I want it to be that. But you know, Zazen's going to be Zazen. You can always rely on that. And actually, life is going to be life, and you can always rely on that too. But sometimes we don't like it. So this mystery is our life. This mystery is Buddhas together with Buddhas doing this mysterious thing. Ho means Dharma, so it means mysterious Dharma, something you can't grasp. This is wondrous Dharma. So wondrous includes this quality. In English, I love the wondrous part because this mystery is a wondrous mystery, which is very encouraging. It's not like a downer mystery. You know, it's not like, okay, we're going into the fun house now. Sometimes it feels like that, but this quality of wondrous Dharma, wondrous Dharma. So I want to tell you a story now that is in a fast school by Dogen called Jinzu, which means mystical power. Okay, here's the story. Zen master Dai Yi is lying down. So he's the big Zen master in the temple, and he's in his room, and he's lying down. Just as his student, his disciple, Kyozan, enters the room, he turns to face the wall. Kyozan says, "Why are you turning to face the wall? I just came in the room." Right? And then Kyozan heads for the exit, and Dai Yi turns over, and he says, "Wait, wait, disciple. Kyozan, come back." And then Kyozan comes back and he says, Dai Yi says, "Well, I had this dream. Let me tell you about my dream so you can give me an interpretation of my dream." So Kyozan responds to that by getting a wash water and a cloth so that Dai Yi can wash his face. So Dai Yi washes his face. And then it turns out that there's another student who's kind of hanging around outside the door whose name is Kyogen. So Dai Yi says, Kyogen comes into the room and Dai Yi says, "Kyozan and I have been sharing miracles. We have been sharing a miracle. This is no small matter." And so Kyogen says, "Well, yeah, I was at the door and I heard you. So I heard this miracle. I saw these mystical powers." Dai Yi said, "Well, why don't you try now?" He says this to Kyogen. "So why don't you try? You do one, please. You do, like, something." So Kyogen makes a cup of tea and gives it to Dai Yi. That's his demonstration. And Dai Yi says, "You two students surpass even Shariputra and even Madgalyayana with your miraculous activity." So Madgalyayana and Shariputra are both primary disciples of the Buddha, right? So he says, "You two guys, Kyozen and Kyogan, you are, like, you know, better than the Buddhist disciples." So what's happening here? So, well, it seems like nothing special is happening here, actually. This is just sort of a day in the life of in the monastery, you know, visiting the teacher. He's been asleep, turns around, says, "Okay, you know, why don't you interpret my dream for me? Well, here's some cloth to wash your face." We never do get the dream interpretation, by the way, so I don't know. So the Lotus Sutra says, well, first of all, there isn't anything special going on here. So what's the difference between this and delusion? What's the difference between the interaction that makes this miraculous coming and going as opposed to just making mistakes are just everyday delusion. So the difference is that, you know, this is the wholehearted, unobstructed kind of call and response event of everyday life that's working pretty well. So you drive your car, you guys know this example, you drive your car, you let somebody in. That's that mysterious, it is mysterious, miraculous dharma. So you go shopping and somebody else is being kind of pushy and you just let them go by. Or whatever it is, your children, you know, you have that wondrous moment with your kids when it's all good. You know, you're kind of working on the same thing there. That's that miraculous power. Only a Buddha with a Buddha. It is a reciprocity, right? It's a reciprocity. It's a wondrous thing. It's a mysterious thing when it's all working together. So the Lotus Sutra says that Buddhas closely attend other Buddhas. This goes back to this hand, warm hand to warm hand. Buddhas closely attending other Buddhas. So what we have here are three Buddhas closely attending each other. Or we have one teacher and two students, two disciples. So, but this story also includes, it includes some difficulties, right? So that's an interesting thing to me about the story, about the difficulties. So, and here's what I would say is the difficulty is that, okay, Dai Yi is lying down at the beginning of the story. Kyozan enters his room, and just as Kyozan enters Dai Yi's room, so he must not have knocked on the door, right? Which I think is fine. You know, so this would be in a probably Chinese monastery, so they've got shoji screens, I'm assuming, and, you know, they pull across in the room. And just at that moment, Dai Yi turns his back to him. So, you know, we would think, oh, in this perfect realm of Buddhas, he would intuit that his disciple was entering the room, and he would just gracefully turn over on his, you know, bed and say, oh, welcome, my disciple, right? But instead, he turns over and faces the wall. So Kyozan, he comes in and he says, let me find out where he says. Here. Kyozan comes in and he says to Dai Yi, he says, Kyozan is the master's disciple. Do not show him your backside. It's what he says to his teacher. I am your disciple. Don't turn your back on me. Right? And Dai Yi, and so then he turns around to leave the room after he says that. And Dai Yi says, disciple Kyozan, let this old monk tell you his dream. See if you can interpret it for me. And the original translation says, can you divine it for me? Right. So he says, wait, he says, disciple Kyozan, let this old monk tell you his dream. So there's this way in which it's really quite sweet, right? Comes in, teacher turns his back, he starts to leave, the teacher says, no, disciple, please don't leave, you know. First the disciple says, wait a minute, I'm your disciple, don't turn your back on me. So this is, to me, is an example of kind of a miscue. It's like we would think that they would automatically have this reciprocal relationship where they would just know automatically. You know, Dai Yi would turn around when Kyozan came into the room. Kyozan came into the room, and Kyozan wouldn't say to his teacher, because we'd think it would be rude, don't turn your back on me. And then the whole thing happens with the teacher saying, you know, oh, you know, you are my disciple, I'm this old monk, please come and tell me about my dreams. So, but there's the way they do it has this quality to me of being very much about individuals, real people, right? The student says, hey, I'm here. Don't turn your back on me. But there's, and then the teacher says, oh, well, you know, please sit down with me and have this intimate moment with me. Come back and have this intimate moment with me. So they're not like processing the way we normally talk about it in a Western way, you know, say, oh, I'm so sorry that I did this thing, so I didn't mean to turn my back on you, but I really love you, so please come back and we'll sit down and, you know, I'll tell you about my dreams and things like that. But there's this way in which there's this kind of good feeling about it. Yet the student is expressing some way that they're unhappy with the situation, but they stay. They don't, Kyozan doesn't say, oh, you know, I'm out of here. There's this way in which there's this kind of smoothness about, do you see what I'm saying? There's this kind of smoothness about their interaction. How can we, as Sangha members, how can we, as students and teachers, how can we find that way in which we can take what is difficult and make it smooth, right? How does that difficulty become a kind of give and take? And I would suggest that it's a trust. There's this deep trust between them. Like they have sat with each other. You know, when you go to the monastery and you sit zazen with people hour after hour after hour after hour after hour, you know, you start to understand something about that person that is not in the intellect. That is some, it's a body understanding. We understand that with our family, right? We understand something. We understand that with our coworkers. So when we are intimate with each other, even though it's not that kind of touchy-feely stuff, when we're intimate, which means that we are living together with someone, we have this way in which we deeply understand who they are. So how can we, you know, be with each other in this way that we sometimes are, where we say things to each other that are not particularly helpful? We create difficulties for each other, for ourselves. How can we find that kind of trust and reciprocity with each other? They say monks are like milk and water. If you pour milk and water together, it completely integrates. If you pour oil and milk together, you end up with like this oily mess on top of the milk, right? Oil and water don't mix. Milk and water, because milk is mostly water, does not mix, right? So how can we be like milk and water with each other? So I think this story is illustrative of that. These are Buddhas with Buddhas, and yet they're real people. They're not some kind of exalted, in some kind of exalted strange situation. So, this is closely, Buddhas closely attending other Buddhas. This is this miraculous power of Buddhas. This is Kyozan coming back. This is Dai-i staying. This is the other disciple, Kyogen, making a cup of tea. So there's this harmony with each other that comes out of living together, that comes out of being with each other, that comes out of a certain level of trust with each other. So can we cultivate that? I think we have a lot of that in our Sangha. I don't think, you know, it's missing. So I'm just saying this, though, to just think about this. You know, think about how this is. So this responding, this staying together, this kind of zazen that we do with each other is very important. So I have more to say about this, but I think I want to stop here and hear what you think about the story. What do you think about this? Any ideas?
I have a question. And I've heard it several times here about super speed. And I have always not quite gotten it, because in my mind, and it may be incorrect, it's not super speed, it's both existing at the same time, not back and forth.
Right. I think, you know, I just remember Katagiri Roshi doing this during lectures. He would go, like, super speed. You know, he had a Japanese accent. He was super speed, like this, and do this, you know. I think his point was that it's all existing simultaneously, and it's not sequential. Okay. Our experience of it is sequential, mm-hmm. because actually we can usually really experience one thing at a time. So if we're experiencing the particular, that's one thing. If we're experiencing the universal, that would be another experience. We usually don't experience them simultaneously, even though simultaneously they both exist. So when you hear in Zen, it's like one thing is hidden, one thing is dark, and the other thing is light, which doesn't mean good and bad. It means one thing is revealed and one thing is hidden. So I would say something like, you know, when we're in the realm of the particular, it's more difficult for us to access the universal, even though they're simultaneously happening at the same time. So for the most part, we're living our lives in the particular. We feel ourselves in our bodies. I don't know what it feels like to be in Dina's body, you know. I know what it feels like to be in my body. She knows what it feels like to be in her body. Yet simultaneously, we are bodies. You know, we have that shared oneness of what it is to be human beings in a body. So there's that quality. Or we say from a dharmic point of view, we are both lack inherent existence, right? So in that way, we say exactly the same. Or you could think of something like, we all know, if we think about it, there are a whole bunch of people down at Verve right now. To take our neighborhood as an example. And yet, we're not thinking about them for the most, until I mention it, right? Probably nobody was thinking about who might be down at Verve. So, but simultaneously, their reality is happening right now, right? There's no difference between this reality and what's going on at Verve, or what's going on in those cars passing by, or what's happening down in the office down there. The reality of a piece of paper on, you know, Kelly's office desk here, the woman who runs the plumbing company right down the hall here. So all those things are happening simultaneously. And yet what we hold is something that our mind is actually experiencing in this moment. So that sense of like, oh, super speed, right? They're both happening simultaneously. And then in that moment, when we actually hold both of those things simultaneously, and it isn't something we can do with our minds, right? It's something that it's this mysterious dharma. And when that happens, it isn't one, and it isn't two, and it's not one, and it's not two, it's like super speed. And in that moment, our response is going to be completely appropriate to what's arising. We're going to pick out those things that are the most important thing at that moment and respond. Yes, sir.
A couple of impressions from the story as well. The first student, when he comes in, I took that as a little bit of delusion because he's making an assumption about why his master turned over. He just had a pain in his side and needed to turn over because it was more comfortable.
Right.
But but like you said, they have this kind of lightness about the interaction, and yet he's expressing, you know, almost being offended. You know,
yeah.
He's assuming that his master is shunning him.
Yeah.
And then that response is just kind of diffusing it, because his master could have also taken offense at, you know, oh, you're so deluded, and gone on that track. And then I found that the miracle, or the mystical property?
Power.
It's just the deep gratitude mm-hmm. that the master showed for mm-hmm. just these simple things that his students were doing for him.
Yeah. Nothing special. They just, you know, the master wakes up, bring him a towel and some water to wash his face. Well, that's done. The other student, what should the other student do? Well, he'll bring the master some tea. Now, it's all centered around Dai in this situation, right? Because they're in the master's room. So you know, that's not surprising. In a Zen story, often it's centered around the master. But this way in which they're completely responding to taking care of him in this situation, right? Well, what does he need next?
But isn't that him ultimately teaching them how to have that, express that deep
That's
gratitude?
Right. That's right. Absolutely. That's his job, is to teach them how to intuitively understand about bringing a towel and water, or about bringing hot tea, because that's essentially what we're doing when we drop the self and allow myriad things to come forward, is that we're just responding to what is necessary in that situation. So, and that is to carry the self forward as delusion, allow myriad things to come forth as realization. Dogen, in Genjo Koan, right? Dogen's, his definition, if you will, of actualizing the Buddha Dharma. It's this way in which we are just in this flow of what's arising. And the flow of what was arising in that moment amongst the three of them was this dynamic. And it might be different in a different situation, but that particular situation, that was their expression. And how do they learn that? By studying the Buddha Dharma, by receiving this transmission, this one-to-one teaching from their teacher, from engaging in the Sangha. There's still three people there. It's not like it's only one person, right?
So, for me, I guess the note, the deep note, just knowing that we're all on the same path and that we're all unskillful, and that it comes down to, again, the compassion in the heart sutra, that, you know, that we're all unskillful, and that, you know, that just in knowing that, it's not personal, or it's not, you know, something that... Where you can move to the next moment.
Yeah, and sometimes something will happen and it really hurts. You know, it's really difficult. And then, please come to Chaku and I. You know, please come and talk to us about, well, you can talk to your fellow Sangha members, but we're here as teachers, so please come and talk to us, and so we can help with the sort of the Dharma understanding of what this is, you know. So there's that way that we receive the teachings from our teachers, and then we go and we try to implement it. And sometimes, if things are difficult, we actually act as mediators, you know. Maybe we have a meeting and actually talk about something. But there's this way of how do we? This is the beauty of Sangha, and this is one of the reasons that I really love the fact that we're doing things together. Thanks to you guys, you know. Coming up with various activities, because we do these things together, and then we find out about each other, and then we're, as the Japanese say, it's potato practice. You put a bunch of potatoes in a water. It doesn't sound very pleasant, actually. Put a lot of potatoes in the water, and you mix them all up, and they knock the dirt off each other. So we're going to mix it up. We're going to end up banging the dirt off each other. So how can we do that in a way that is trustful, skillful, understanding what you're saying, Deidre, which is we're going to make mistakes.
And then we learn so much from that.
We do.
Both parties or everybody.
Yeah. Absolutely. We do. And that's how we learn. That's how we learn from each other. So. And we also have joy. We also have that wondrous Dharma, too. Right. Maybe more of that than the other. But it also seems, the other seems big.
But I think a lot of joy comes out of knowing... You learn about yourself, right?
Yeah.
And you learn about other people and
That's
how
right.
to mix the milk and the water, and that brings joy, because that's what we're all, it's all about, right?
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Yeah. Steve, were you going to say something?
No.
Go ahead, Dina.
I was just going to say, I love how, for me in the time that I am in my life now, how the Dharma just gives me those ever so gentle reminders of parenthood. And what I got from that story was the master, the parent, and the child who takes a quicker offense to something.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I'm imperfect, so my response isn't always as lucky as I'd like it to have been. But that reminder that just to, you know, to just react in a different manner, which can change the whole entire experience, the whole situation. And I just thought that was incredibly beautiful. Like Steve had pointed out, that he could have reacted a different way and things could have escalated, and to keep things on that wondrous, peaceful, super speed sort of feeling, and to pay attention to our reactions as human beings, and for me as a parent, and a reminder that I heard myself in every single one of those people. Mm-hmm. I heard my children in every single one of those people.
Yeah,
it was really quite beautiful.
Yeah, and I love the fact that he, you know, Dai, in the context, it's very intimate for him to say to his student, please come and listen to my dream, you know, and tell me what you hear, tell me what you understand. Because what he understands has to also be something about Dai, right? Because when somebody says, well, we interpret our dreams, we also go, well, okay, I know this person, and da-da-da-da-da, you know, we say something. And so it's very intimate, actually, a very intimate experience. And I see your hand. And it also, this is this way that it asks for Kyozan to bring forth his wisdom. You know, it really enforces Kyozan's wisdom to say, yes, disciple, come over here and give me some of your wisdom.
I was just thinking about what she said, and how with my son, he's so sensitive to people's body language and their faces mm-hmm. and their mm-hmm. expressions, that one thing that I've learned from it here too, which has been so wonderful with him, and I think he's seen it change both ways with him and myself, is that he would be like, Mom, don't look at me that way. Or I'm like, how did I look at you? either he thinks I'm giving him a guilt trip because he doesn't want to do the dishes or something, mm-hmm. and he'll be like, don't look at me like that. And so so instead of just getting in this thing back and forth, I've actually sat down with them and I said, what is the space, you know, to you? Mm-hmm. Because it's probably not what you're thinking. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. just my face, and it has a lot of character, you know, it does stuff. And, you know, it's like, I may not be able to control it. And if maybe you're thinking something different than my face, or maybe you're right on.
Yeah.
But let's talk about it.
Yeah.
And because he also does these, you know, these things right. that a teenager does that drives me crazy, or you just look just like your father when you do that, and And so we sat down and talked about it, mm-hmm. and it was really, really wonderful, because there's so much that we don't even say that puts out so many, you know, it can, like the turning the back.
Yeah.
We didn't even have to say anything.
Yeah.
And we have so much, when in the Heart Sutra, you know, the delusions or the misperceptions mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. that are so fast to get triggered.
Yeah.
And without even saying anything. So, anyway, so thank you.
Yeah, that's great. So that's that way that we, essentially, it's slowing down and presencing ourselves. You know, it's like we... Because what you're talking about before you do that, when you don't do that, it's like you go bang, 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 bang. You know, this cascading effect of assumptions.
And it's a domino effect on both sides, and it just creates...
Just like, you know, then there's just havoc with everybody kind of like making all these assumptions. But if you can slow down right. and sit in the midst of that, it really makes a difference.
And when we sat down, basically what we both agree on is that we love each other wholeheartedly and we want what's best for each other. My son and I.
Right,
know?
Right.
And so,
instead
of doing the nitpicky and all that, it was more like really just coming down and saying, we got each other's, you know?
Yeah, we got each other's back.
This love is very strong, so what are we doing here?
I think I actually focus more on the third disciple and the actions.
Mm-hmm.
So when he said, you know, come in, we're doing miracles. And I know, I saw him. you know, we're on the earth, which is the perfect distance from the sun, to have all this life happening. The tendons and the bones and the muscles rolling over. The act of making tea where you're pouring hot water over the leaves that somebody else picked in. This magical process. So all of these things, they are miracles. They're miraculous. Not special at all.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But they're miracles.
Yeah.
And so when he said, come in, we're making miracles. Show me your own. He went, I saw them. I made you some tea.
Yeah.
And it is a miracle.
Yeah.
Even though it's nothing special.
Yeah.
And so that's where my mind went more.
Yeah. And that's the wondrous Dharma. You know, that's that wondrous Dharma. That it requires an amazing amount of cooperation.
And being awake to it is the other miracle.
Yeah, the being awake to it, right? Mm-hmm. This being awake to it. That's what we're being asked to do, to wake up to this, these miraculous things that are going on, this mysterious and wondrous dharma that's happening all the time. And not just waking up to it, but, you know, like this, according ourselves with that dharma, wanting to accord ourselves with that dharma. And over time, what we see is that that being in accord feels better, right? That being in accord makes us happy, you know, where the discord does not. But initially, we think the discord will make us happy. Initially, it's like we think, if I fight back, if I say, you did this thing to me, you know, then I'm going to be happier. So, I think Liz wanted to say something first.
It occurred to me also that the first disciple, when he came into the room and his teacher turned his back, he could have just left.
Well, he did start to walk out the door.
Not until he said, hey, you turned your back on me.
Oh, that's right.
Disciple.
Yes, thank you.
And then he started to leave. Now, you, I would think on the face of it, if he walked in, saw his teacher turn his back, if he had backed out quietly, that would have been more skillful than saying, hey, you just turned your back on me.
Well, you know, I'm not so sure, Liz.
I'm not either. because as I was thinking,
that's our idea about what might be most skillful.
Exactly. I think in a certain way he was being very direct.
Yeah.
He was saying, this is how I receive what you're doing, mm-hmm. Which is giving the teacher an opportunity to also be direct and without offense or guile. So what would seem like almost a combative beginning to the story was, in a sense, what made it all possible, what made the miracle possible.
Yeah, that willingness to come forward and speak your mind. So he speaks his mind in this very direct way, but they have this intimacy between each other, so it's not an unskillful thing. But I also agree with you that, Steve, that the generosity of the teacher, the parent figure in this, allows some spaciousness to happen in there. So it's not like a cascading event of ego, essentially. You know, like, I'm getting upset because you did this thing to me. Because the story is ambiguous enough, the way it's written, that I really think that there's a simultaneity of student comes in the door, teacher rolls over kind of thing. There is not any, there's actually no correlation between the two. It's just happenstance. And that there's this intimacy where Kyozan can say, and I just love the fact that he's so direct, you know, he says, your disciple, Kyozan, I am your disciple, Kyozan, turn around, don't turn your back on me. So, you know, it's like, hey, what am I, chopped liver here? You know, I'm here. So I love the fact that there is this kind of aggressiveness in a way about his response. But it's so, it's like, we don't know exactly how he said it. We don't know exactly how the intonation was, you know. It could have been, I'm your disciple. Please don't turn your back on me. You know, we don't know what that really was, but that reciprocity amongst all the qualities that are happening is like so important. And that's a miraculous thing. That willingness to have that spaciousness to let it be. And it wouldn't have happened if he hadn't said that, is what your point is, right? It wouldn't have happened if he hadn't have said it. And so the question is, you know, how can we do that in a way that's skillful? How can we say to the other person, ooh, this is like difficult for me. This is, I'm having a hard time here, you know, but how can we work with this? Because we don't always, we can't assume the other person's going to come back with generosity. We can't assume the other person's going to, you know, just give us the space. I think as we're kids, we always assume our parents are going to give us that space, even though they may or may not be skillful, but it's like we're just kind of like, we don't care. we're just going to do our thing. Like, we're going to throw ourselves down on the floor in the supermarket and start screaming. It doesn't really matter, you know, who else is around. How, when do we get out, grow out of that? Well, I think usually when peer pressure starts to work on your mind. I don't know. I can't remember this, but you know. But we do a version of that as adults where we throw ourselves down on the floor and we go, I don't want this, you know, or I want this, or whatever it is, you know, we're like on the floor. And we hope that our friends are like, you know, okay, give us generosity. But it doesn't always happen, so it's better when we are more skillful. Does that make sense? I'm kind of like getting off here, but yes, Randy.
I wanted to say something about when you were talking about things being aligned and how we feel like it's safer or better when we're not. I recently read an incredibly moving article in this the current New Yorker about the 33 Chilean miners that were stuck in the mine for 69 days. Mm-hmm. And there's a guy writing a book about it, which I'm absolutely going to get. And it seems that, I mean, it was 104 degrees and 98% humidity. And for the first 2 weeks, they didn't know if they were going to live or die. They could only eat half a cookie and one cup of motor oil-filled water every other day. That's all they had. Everyone got along perfectly. They established someone to lead them in prayer sessions every day. And they had a confession every day, where people listen and confess from the very deepest parts of themselves. It was sacred. And they talked about the 33 people being the age of Christ when he died. And you know, and they thought they could very well die. They heard drills coming, but they were kept missing. Finally, when the drill hit and they knew they were going to be rescued, there was dissension all over the place. I was actually the leader. No, I was me. I'm going to sell my deal to the buyer and get, you know. And it became quite difficult. And the difference between the line, the same situation, they're still stuck down there, and they were stuck down there for another however many days, 50 days or so. But they were no longer in alignment.
Well, that's fascinating, isn't it?
It is
interesting. Yeah. Definitely something to think about there. That's, you know, that thing of, well, practice is only good when you're under duress, and then as soon as things get better, well, chuck it out the window, right? Well, what's wrong with this picture? Yes, Nancy.
It was thinking even that, I think that's a good example of it too, that it, in the story, the two people or the three people have to, they all have to believe, but they all have to be practicing the same, like, bowing kind of to the same teachings, and trust that they each one will, maybe not immediately, but as best they can, follow those teachings.
Yeah.
And also to be able to speak.
Yeah.
Mind.
Yeah. So they're basically all on the same page, you know. So they have this essential trust with each other. How can we cultivate that kind of trust with each other and other people, right? That's not a kind of idiot trust, right? How do we cultivate a kind of discernment where we can take that trust and appropriately place it? You know, because that's part of this too. So, you know, how does that work? So I just offer that to you as a koan. I don't have the answer for that. Do you have the answer, Holly?
No, I don't. I'm very much in process. It's going to take another lifetime, at least. No. But I had an experience the other day where I received an unexpected apology. I guess they're always unexpected. They're fairly old-fashioned nowadays, I think. Anyway, so, you know, in my mind, this person had really behaved pretty crazily. So anyway, they come up to me and just start apologizing. And it was a quality apology, too. It was quite good.
But I was standing there, you know, and just for like, I guess a super speed or a nanosecond, I could feel this little tiny bit of resistance, like, and I knew what it was about. It was about, you know, wanting to cross the T and dot the I. Like, do they know? And they also did this and this, you know. And then I just let it go because I could feel the suffering in that for me and for them. And it just didn't seem to matter. It felt like, you know, too, later when I thought about it, that the way to bring the Dharma there is to see the Dharma that's happening right in that moment, which was the apology.
Yeah.
You know, instead of wanting more, that was my ego getting defensive. It seemed that way. And I also thought, well, you know, I'm not marrying this person. I don't really have to have to make sure they never do it again, right? No. Anyway, so I just wonder if you have any comments about that.
I think that's absolutely true. You know, we're being offered probably something that was difficult for that person to do, right?
So.
It's really difficult. And to have the generosity to meet that person where they are and not say, oh, but I want it to be like this. I want it to be like this. Mm-hmm. I once had a mediated conversation where I was the bad guy. I wasn't the mediator. I was the, you know, person who theoretically was the problem. And the other person wanted to hear from me in a particular language, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was told by the mediator I had to sit there and they would say, now say it this way. Mm-hmm. No, that's not good enough. Say it this way. Say it this way. That takes all the fun out of it, you know, to have somebody like force you to use a particular kind of language or something, you know. It's like it's a very soul-killing event to be put in that situation. So to have the generosity, to have the awakeness, Holly, to be able to be awake enough to see your mind go into that place of, wait a minute, I don't like this, I want it to be different, you know, and then to let go of that. That's our practice, you know, that's the wondrous Dharma, is that waking up to hearing that little voice in our head and going, thank you very much, but I don't think so, you know, I'm going to do this other thing. It's, you know, very good.
I think that would have created for me a struggle, you know, and it would have taken me from a pleasantly surprised place to a place of struggle.
So,
and that's a good story.
Because it would have been, you know, so often it's like, we want it to be our way, and our way is very prescribed, very, you know, we're like just got this really narrow thing, and we are not allowing myriad things to rise simultaneously. We're carrying the self forward. So that small self started to come forward, and your big self said, down.
Relax.
Take a breath. You know, this is not the happy road. You know, we're not going to do this.
Well, I was just, your comment about them having to trust that they were all, the thing that popped up in my head was, well, why? Why did they have to trust that? I think, because I was thinking about, most of the time, and it's probably true for all of us, when I go out into the world, most of the time, people are trying to deal with the world in very different ways.
Yeah.
Because most of the people I interact with don't have a Buddhist practice, they might have some other religion, or not, or have no concept of any of that kind of thing. And so, I think if I try and like force that on them, like you have to be doing it my way or the way that I learned, or you know, or I, you know, but I think you can still trust in your practice the idea that all beings want to be happy and avoid suffering. I think that part is very true, but I think it's if you try and if that's what you're kind of like putting your agenda forward, doesn't mean you have to put up with everything. I've been running into a big problem at work because one of my students has two moms. And he's a kid that doesn't take responsibility and is very whiny and runs around. And a few of my coworkers actually made he doesn't have a man running. He's whiny because he's got two females, and like, I had to address that. I'm just, you know, and I chose to use humor. I just said it's not about gender; it's about crazy. But you know. But I think that's the thing is I trust them that they are good people that are doing their best and want to avoid suffering, all that kind of stuff. But then you also have to, you know, I don't know.
Well, exactly. Shantideva talks about, this is, you know, in Tibetan Buddhism, they really break all this stuff down. And Shantideva talks about, you know, everyone comes to a situation with their own causes and conditions, right? So everyone is conditioned by the life that they've led, the ideas that they have, whatever. So in this case, there's a sexist causes and conditions. They wouldn't call it that, but that's what I would call it, right? There's a series of causes and conditions. You get to this point, and you bring all that baggage with you, right? And so if we're the recipient, if we're part of that conversation, I think what you're saying is that we have to acknowledge that everybody, including ourselves, comes with this stuff, you know? And the question is, can we meet that person and find some common ground, you know, and see their basic goodness and to be able to have this dialogue? Because if we come with this huge resistance and defensiveness and aggression on somebody, well, there's no dialogue there. We don't like to dialogue when we feel like we're being aggressed on and feel defensive. So in the teaching, it's like, it's not personal, which is how you diffuse that. It's not personal. This person's causes and conditions that brought them to this, to say, it's because two women are the parents and not a man and a woman is the cause of this child's problem, is it's not personal to you, Mark. I mean, it's not personal, the conversation. And they're not saying that to you because they know that you are, you know, pro-lesbian or something like that. They're saying it because this is how they think. And it's not personal. Do you know what I'm trying to say? So it's like that helps diffuse that for us, so that even if it is personal, even if it is somebody, they're thinking to themselves, this is personal, I'm going after this person, it's still not personal, because they're making decisions based on a series of causes and conditions that aren't about you at all. Their decision to attack you, to kind of hit you below the belt or something, is a decision that's based on some real delusion on their part that's not about you. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So it's like it helps us, if we can remember that, it helps, it's a technique, right? It's true, but it's also a technique to diffuse something, and that, so there's that.
Yeah, I feel like in your example with the mediated discussion, the person wanted their apology in a very specific way.
Yeah.
But I feel like it actually ended up getting less of what they wanted.
Yes.
Because by trying to force you to say it in their particular right way, I imagine it was frankly less genuine.
Right.
Was,
you know, I just ended up mouthing the words that they wanted to hear.
Yeah.
And then I was told that I didn't say it with the appropriate amount of feeling. Mm-hmm. It was like one, I mean, can you imagine? This was a hell realm. Right. This was a hell realm of how can I escape this thing. So I sat there with my theater degree and did my best that I could do to say it once more with feeling. It's like all that, you're right, when you force people into mirroring back to you in some very specific way what you want to see, so that you are having some idea that you have mirrored back to you, you lose that other person so completely. You know, it's like they cannot be present for you because you're completely negating that person. So it's like all you're seeing is yourself. Does that make sense? All you're asking is, you're saying, show me myself. Don't show me you. I don't care about you. All I want to see is myself. And that's a problem. That's a problem. So that's a problem with power, unequal, really seriously unequal power dynamics, where people are not, the person in more power isn't aware, doesn't see the other person as a human being. That's when we start getting into that kind of stuff. Yeah, Liz.
Thinking about the Chilean miners, mm-hmm. And how they were in accord until the drill came through and they knew they would live. Plainly, there was a factor of impending death that created this openness and almost compassionate discipline that was happening, because death was imminent. And the minute they saw the drill come through, okay, now we're not going to die. which is absolutely where delusion comes in and takes over, because we are going to die. And I'm reminded, I recently read Zen Master Raven, and the book comes down to me to this distilled one thing, and that is, we're all in this together, and we don't have much time.
Yeah. So, to me, the part about we're all going to die is absolutely not a motivator for me at all in my practice. It is traditionally very much a Buddhist motivator. You know, you don't have a lot of time. It's enough motivation for me to just the Bodhisattva vow. You know, just how can I be most skillful in this situation? How can I be most skillful? So maybe I take this back. Maybe the motivator is, you know, I guess I've gotten to the place now where it's really clear to me it's right now, right now, right now. There isn't any other place to do it. So maybe the motivator of you're going to die is don't regret it. Don't be on your deathbed and say, I wish I would have apologized to that person. I wish I would have tried to be more skillful. Do you know what I'm saying? I think maybe that is the motivator for it. Do you find it really motivating to think that... What?
Yes, I do.
Yes, you do. And it is.
I think
it
of the five remembrances.
Yeah.
And for me, the fact that you will run out of time...
Yeah.
I find just personally is... It really sort of lights a fire under me in a certain way to say... you can't procrastinate. You can't...
You have to do it, like, right now.
Do it now.
Do it now.
Do it now.
All right, I take it back. The teaching is, life is impermanent. Do not waste time. Wake up, wake up, wake up right now. Because you want to.
Well, it also teaches me, this is great. I'm here.
Yeah.
You know, I can get loose.
Well, yeah, I feel that sense of, like, we were talking about this on Tuesday night. We were talking about death and change and old age and all this. And yeah, it's like we, and we were just talking about this last night, this sense of, I'm 64, right? So when I look at somebody who's 40, right, I think to myself, or younger or whatever, I think, you don't know. You know, and then I think, but when I'll be 80, if I make it to 80, I'll look back at 60 and say, what was your problem? You know? Yeah.
We should probably...
So I hear what you're saying, everybody has to think that I could go in that same direction, but when I think about it, I don't want fear to be a motivator, mm-hmm. and I think that even if I could say I'm not afraid to die, that's always going to be there. And so, to me, like, that love is letting go of fear. And so I wouldn't want that to be personally my motivator. Because it's I know that when we had the earthquake and, you know, different things happen, that's true, that people become so much more friendly. And because, it just like with the mining, it just, for some reason it does that to us. But... I don't want that to be my motivator. I want it to be more heart-centered than fear-centered.
So so in the case of the earthquake, or what Randy's talking about, and I think probably what you're talking about too, Liz, is this way in which we pay attention to that gratitude that arises, and then let go of the fear part, and put our focus because what we're talking about is in those moments we really understand that we are an interconnected organism. Right, that's what we understand, and so we start functioning that way. Jaku tells me that we should stop, because it is true, we're going to do the Bodhisattva ceremony. So let's do the ending chant.